Welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 63 with Shiva Khalili.
Hopefully, I said that
correctly. Awesome. So yeah, welcome everybody. If you enjoy what you hear today, you can follow us at becomecgpro.com or in our Facebook group. So it's a pleasure to have you on today. I'm going to do a very brief introduction and then we'll get into things. But I know Shiva's a virtual production supervisor who's been working at Lux Machina, an awesome company doing virtual production. Comes from a theater background, and I'm going to leave it there and let you fill in the blanks. But it's a pleasure to have you on today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You bet. So, yeah, I would love to start just by talking about how you got here, because we were just talking about this offline. I know about how everybody kind of ended up in virtual production by accident.
In it 100%. Being a
fairly, right. Yeah, it's a new industry. Well, no, not new industry, but a new way of doing things. Several new ways of doing things, which are extensions of ways we used to be doing things. But everybody got here by accident. Everyone has either been in production already. I'd love to hear a little bit about how you got here, but especially if there was like things early on in your life that made you that influenced your decisions, or like how did you start off? Did you study for this?
Not really. I mean, I have a degree in scenic design for theater from UCLA. And I was in school right around the time that everyone was starting to put projections into every theatrical production. So I learned to program that side of things. I was really comfortable with things like Photoshop. I'd worked as an assistant to a wedding photographer in high school and learned quite a bit about that. And so I was already familiar with some of the tools. And so picking up programming for projections for theater was really simple. And it just kept bringing me opportunities both within UCLA and then after. So I went from there. I worked at Disney for a minute. Both in the park in Anaheim, and then I got called out to go to Shanghai when they were building Shanghai Disney, and I spent 4 months there. I got called out because I knew how to program Watch Out, and then learned how to install the rest of the video system I was responsible for. Learned it well enough to assemble manuals, get those translated into Mandarin, and train a team through an interpreter on how to use them and troubleshoot all those tools. So I learned a lot really fast. Thanks a lot to like the colleagues that I was working with there who took me under their wing. Was very green at the time and just learned so much. And when I got back, I thought I wanted to be in film, being like a production designer, because like that's a right sidestep from scenic design. And so I started working for a construction coordinator in TV, spent a couple years working for him and like really seeing the TV industry and realizing that being a production designer wasn't what I wanted. But I loved getting to be on set. And so learning that I wanted to be on set, but in a different role, I think was valuable. And at the time I was doing quite a bit of freelance work, both theatrical design, designing a lot of operas. And then I also was working as a wedding planner, which seems unrelated, but I promise it's related. I like to say that, you know, coming down a bride on her wedding day is not that different from talking to a director. So it got me really comfortable. Yeah, exactly. So it got me like really comfortable working with people, and like it's essentially a big production. And I think that's what, once I was in virtual production, led me to a role as a VP soup, a virtual production supervisor, because I'm so comfortable like working both with the client and managing a team and managing multiple like contractors and vendors and all of that. But I had left kind of all those jobs and was on a little journey to find myself, sort of. About 5 years ago, I quit the jobs I was at, everything I couldn't do remotely, and I got in my car and I spent 4 months just kind of on a road trip, trying to decide what I wanted to do next. And while I was there, I was applying to jobs both inside the industry and out of the industry. And I got a call from a friend out of the blue that said, "Hey, like, Lux Machina is hiring. You're the right person for this job. You need to call them right now." And so entirely out of the blue, I'd called a connection that I hadn't spoken to in 8 years, something like that. And called him out of the blue and said, "Hey, Johnny told me to call you. That's all the information I have." And it ended up becoming this incredible adventure. I spent over 5 years at Lux. I've gotten to work in every element of virtual production, in camera visual effects specifically, in that like volume building. And so everything from building systems and designing systems to programming, to producing, to camera tracking. Like I got to experience it all, because I joined the company when it was six people, and really like scrappy. and I got to grow with that company quite a bit. And so it's, now we talked about this, I've left my job at Lux and like, I'm looking for the next opportunity, but I got to grow quite a bit and get to really love this industry and love this technology. Yeah, that's kind of the story.
Right. Brings us up to today. Yeah. Very cool. Well, yeah, there's so much in there, and I really loved how you were talking, particularly because this is something that really resonates with me, is what I describe as call the existential crisis, where crisis isn't a negative thing. It's really transformational moment, I guess, where you're trying to figure out what's next. And I feel like that happens roughly every 5 years to me. And the way you explained it in taking what I used to call a perspective break by going away and doing something else completely, it's really difficult to figure out what you're doing when you're in the middle of it. But I think it's a great thing that you described there about going on your road trip and trying to get some perspective. What was that like? What was that piece of time like?
I call it my quarter life crisis. Definitely a lot of confusion and self-discovery, in that I had always been on a kind of direct path of like, you know, I knew I wanted to go to university. I always kind of knew what I wanted to do next and what I wanted to try next. And then I got to a point where it was like everything I'd tried that thus far, like it hadn't been everything I expected it to be. And I hadn't really found something I could like dig into and really like get passionate about. And so I think taking a break from all of that and getting myself out of my comfort zone and doing something with no path allowed me to kind of be comfortable with that. And then it was as though I came back to LA and everything fit together. I got this job and a couple other like elements of my life just kind of like fell into place. And it's like everything had been up in the air and then just kind of fit. And so
do you feel like that was an important act, like the act of going away and just letting go?
Yeah, for me in particular, it was the first time I really let myself be unsure of what was next, and down to like a day-to-day basis, like I was just kind of going with the flow. Like I had all my camping supplies, I had a map of campgrounds, and then just let myself go wherever I felt like that day, and kind of experience the the freedom of not having a plan, which I think fit really well, and like to intentionally not have a plan, I think was really valuable. Because again, like so much of this industry happens on accident. Like, even my time at Disney, the one person who was deciding who was going to Shanghai had seen me program Watch Out one time. And like, that was what made me the person that they sent to China. And then because I was there, I learned so much from it and made all these other connections that have then like, become some of my closest friends and like favorite people to work with. And so there's so much like that happens that's out of our control that like taking some of that control back without a plan, I think was really, really valuable for me and like my personal growth.
That's
And it
cool.
worked out for my career too, so I'll take it.
It's interesting because I think we're so cultured to from a really early age to make decisions for the rest of your life. When you're, I talk a lot to younger and younger people now, sometimes at high school age, about the situation they're in and decisions they're supposed to make. I remember myself with of being in that position where you have to choose what's the next 2 years going to be like, because that's really important to make sure that the next several years at college is going to be right, and then that's going to really impact your entire life. Like you feel like at the age of 15, 16, like you really need to make the right choice then, otherwise you're screwed. Life's not going to work out. And flash forward a little while of living it, and that's not true. But I think going to that age, it does feel like life puts a lot of pressure on you to figure it out, and to feel like you have this plan and you're just acting it out. Whereas when actually having a plan sometimes leads you down a path that isn't necessarily the right one for you, and but you feel that pressure to stay on it and keep on it. I've had a couple of career changes already because of that, just being on the, maybe the road was right for a bit, but maybe not for forever.
And like I planned to come back from that trip and I was looking at web design jobs and the job in virtual production just kind of fell into my lap and it's one of the best things I've ever done. Like it's I'm so grateful. And it was not at all the plan. It was so far off from the plan. And I just kind of took a leap.
What do you think the sort of significant things that you did have control over that made it happen?
I had a lot of like friends who'd kind of wound up in the same place, whether from Disney or from UCLA or, from other projects I'd done, had kind of gotten there. And then one of the like, I guess, skills I learned in Shanghai was that I'm not afraid of what I don't know, which I think a lot of people are. I knew that I was jumping into an industry that I knew nothing about. And so did Lux. Like they knew that they weren't going to find someone. I mean, 5 years ago there was no one with all these skills. And so they knew I had no idea what I was doing, and I knew I had no idea what I was doing, but we were both willing to take that leap. And my friend who helped train me while I was at Shanghai Disney taught me to just read the manual. Which makes things suddenly so much less intimidating that there is a manual for it, so that willingness to read the manual, to learn it myself, to watch a YouTube video and Google the answers and slam my head against a wall until I get it to work. I think that is one of the things that made me like appealing for Lux.
Right. Your essentially your resourcefulness.
And lack of fear. Like, I think there's so many people that particularly when you're looking at like a broadcast show or something that's live, there's so many people that approach it from a place of fear and from a yeah like a not wanting to not want like a fear of failure, I guess, and a fear of making a mistake that they will never try. And I think that willingness to try is what makes certain people successful in this industry in general, like within all of film, within all of new technology. It's that willingness to just kind of jump in, try something new, see what happens. And if you fail, you fail. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And to be all right with that, to be okay with the fact, like there's a sort of stigma around failure a lot of the time. There's a lot of discussion around the positive mm-hmm. aspects of it as well, the necessity of it, the need to try something new, because otherwise you're not going to do anything new if you don't try something new. And you see, you have to, but the fear can be crippling for some people, that it stops them mm-hmm. trying in the beginning. What is there any kind of tricks to that for you in because the fear part's still usually
it's there. Still there, it's always there. There's
yeah,
I'm still the person during every broadcast show with my heart beating super fast, just like praying it works. Particularly when we're doing like XR or something for broadcast, it's like there's so many variables, and if it doesn't work, it's very apparent.
Yeah.
But I remember that, like, I guess audiences approach art that they are passionate about with a sense of forgiveness that we don't always give people credit for, that, like, particularly when things are live, there's a forgiving nature about them. And, like, yes, there will always be the person who, like, finds the massive failure and puts it on YouTube for everyone to see forever and ever. But the people who care are more excited about the parts that work. And in the end, like, there'll be another show. There's always another show. There will be something else for people to get excited about. And you don't progress without some amount of failure.
Right.
So it's reminding myself that, and then still having the heart attack.
Yeah. Being able to keep moving regardless of what you're seeing in front of you, just having that kind of faith component.
Yeah.
And we are doing that right now. This is live, being broadcast live currently, unless you're watching the replay. And to our audience, because of that, feel free to ask questions. We will do our best to get to them if you wish to ask questions. But yeah, this is a really interesting subject, because I think running a school, I see a lot of people wanting to do, essentially this is what schools are. They're a place mm-hmm. where people are trying to have a transformational experience. They're trying to change. They're trying to accomplish something new and trying to acquire skills to be able to do it. So I've spent my life around people who are in that sort of existential transformational moment, and see a lot of the fear that comes in as a result, and see the people pushing through it, progressing through it. Are there any kinds of qualities that you think, or you've mentioned just bearing in mind that, or the knowledge that it's kind of a necessary mm-hmm. part, that fear is necessary, that you will get through it, you always have. Are there any other kind of tricks to get to stepping past that feeling?
I think there's a sense that, like, one of the challenges for me has always, like, been being honest with myself. I guess explaining that one. I think it's hard sometimes to understand that, like, something that you've set your mind to isn't for you. Mm. And, like, for me, that thrill of a broadcast life, and that stress, for lack of a better term, like, is something that I thrive on. I do really well under pressure. It's not always the best thing for, like, my brain or my body, but I do thrive under it, and I seek it in a sense, but it's not for everyone. And so I think allowing yourself the flexibility of, like, okay, like, maybe this isn't for me. And I know for me, like, being a freelance theater designer was something that, like, I truly loved doing, but it was making me miserable because it was such a toll on my mental health. And so coming to terms with that, straight out of college was really challenging for me. And I kept trying for years and years. And still, like, part of me is like, well, what if I went back to that? But I know that like it's not good for me as a person, and it's not good for the life that I want to lead. And like I don't need to commit to that. I don't have to do something just because I set my mind to it. I can change what I want. And I think giving your, like, I would recommend to any like young artist or young engineer to like give yourself that flexibility too, and like give yourself the freedom to realize that something isn't right for you, and that you're allowed to change your mind. Because when I think about it, like, you know, I've been in the industry for over a decade now, and I've changed careers so many times. And like, that's not that long. Like, there's quite a bit of my career ahead of me, and I will change multiple times between now and retirement. You know, if I get to retire, hopefully. We'll see.
That's a whole other interesting idea that people are aspiring to retirement. But basically, anyone that retires and stops doing anything really don't like it, and they want to figure out something else to do. But yeah, anyway, the really interesting talking about these concepts, which we often get into the sort of technical weeds, but I think this is really, really, really useful to talk about, because I think everybody goes through this stuff. And, mm-hmm. and it's not just about when you're 16, you're trying to figure out what you're doing for the rest of your life. You visit it again at 21, and then 26, and then 31, and or maybe even more frequently than that, of just trying to figure out what, for me, it's always been, am I doing the best thing that I can do for me and for the world, and like using my skills to in the best way that I can. Because I think the your purposefulness, your just feeling good comes from doing something where you're good at it, you like doing it, and the world needs it. And there's a bunch of Venn diagrams out there on the internet that seem to think the same thing. But that seems to to tally for me, where you're and you change during your life, you change and evolve yourself, and the world changes too. It's like talking about virtual production being a relatively new term, that's the world changing and coming up with some new ways of doing things which weren't a thing before. And then you're changing and growing and experiencing things and seeing new things. What's your guide? How do you know what things you want to follow and what things you maybe need to let go?
If I knew that, I'd be so much happier, Ed. I don't know.
Is it a feeling? Is it like,
you know,
like
it's a feeling, yeah.
And that like is just something. It's like I wanted to be a character animator at the beginning of my career, and I realized after 6 or 7 years of torturing myself into pushing myself to be one of those, that I actually didn't really like the mechanics of the job.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting much better at it because I wasn't putting the hours in. But it took me years to acknowledge that and be honest with myself about that. So I think it's just an interesting idea of like how you get that insight of when it's time to move on, and or what it is that you're being pulled towards. So it's a very, yeah. I know it's quite a deep question. So
I think it's a lot of like, it takes a long time to figure it out every time. Like every time I make any sort of change in my career, it's been a, okay, well, this isn't working for me. And then trying to reflect on why. Is it the space I'm in? Is it the job itself? Is it other things in my life? And trying to figure that out. But I think some of the things that I look for in any job, in any project, is a sense of motivation. Whether I'm motivated to do well for the team that I'm working with, or I'm motivated to do well for my personal growth, or I'm motivated to do well for the creative intent of the project. I need that driving force. Because I do better work when I care more.
Yeah.
And so that's really appealing. And like, I think, for me, like having a good team, having a team that I care for is one of the top motivational factors there. And I think that's why I loved my job at Lux so much, was because I got to work with some incredible people who cared a lot. And even when it was hard, even when the project wasn't exciting, I got to like sit with these like driven, talented, interesting people. And work with people who are like, everyone's like the best person in that job, you know, like everyone's like the most qualified person to be doing what they're doing. Like, and it's, I think that's a caliber I strive for.
Real gift. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so rare. I mean, like they're incredible people, incredible, talented people in this industry, but like, I don't know, you don't like everyone, like you don't have to, but to really care for the people that you're working with and have mass amounts of respect for them is such a gift.
It makes you bring your A game, right?
Yeah. And it makes everyone bring their A game, which makes it a better process, a better experience altogether. I think that motivation and that strong team are something that I look for. But then one of the things that I'm looking for more now is trying to achieve work-life balance, and trying to understand like just how much of myself I want to give for these things that I love and that motivate me and that get me excited. And how much I also want to spend time with my dog. Like,
I saw him in the background.
Oh yeah, she left. She's right. My office manager. She's the real boss.
Good one to have. Yeah, it's a tricky one, that one. When you figured it out, let me know and you can come back on the podcast.
If you have any tips, I would love to chat.
another episode we could probably dedicate to that. Yeah. My only solution so far is to be out of balance in different things over time. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to accomplish at any one point in time with every component of your life all together, but doable. As long as you're improving a thing, this is my opinion, you're not letting any of them go to zero and you're tending to all the gardens a bit, but usually you're tending to one more than the others.
Yeah.
At some point, and it's good if you kind of swap them around, then I feel like you're able to push each one forwards a bit at any one time. If you try and push them all forwards at the same time, it can be quite difficult. But that's a tough one, but a very important one too, because I think everyone in the industry has experienced that kind of, especially when you love something, you want to give everything to it, and it wants everything from you, and it will never tell you to not give more. It's tricky.
And it's like,
great.
Yeah. Like I love projects that I travel for, because you get to a place where like there are no distractions and everyone's like just focused on doing the best possible work they can. But I traveled almost half the year last year. Like, it takes a toll on you after a while. And so trying to find the balance of like, this is thrilling and this is pushing me to grow in my career versus, is that everything I want?
Changes over time. I think you'll get years where you do that and then other years where you just don't want to go anywhere. And then you're like, don't go anywhere for a while and you want to go traveling again.
Yep.
I think those impulses are good to listen to, because that's somehow something's telling you to change something. Which is good. We've got a couple of specific questions here from the audience. So someone's asking, do you use Watch Out at all in conjunction with virtual production? There's so much emphasis on LED these days, but I still love big projection.
I haven't used Watch Out since I've done theater. So it's been a few years, but I will say that there is a use for projection in virtual production for sure. So it's two-sided. It's like, instead of Watch Out, I would use something like Pixera or Disguise, a little bit of a stronger media server, and that's not to say that you can't use Watch Out. These are just the tools that I've been using in particular these last few years. But if you're deciding between projection and LED, like there are pros and cons to both. Should I go into it?
Sure.
How technical can I get? Okay.
Very nerdy audience, probably.
I'm ready. So I think so when you're looking at projection versus LED, there are pros and cons to each. An LED wall is like emissive light source, so you get better reflections, better interactive lighting from something like LED, which is why projects like The Mandalorian used massive LED screens, because his suit was all metal and all reflective, and you just wanted all of those reflections that you can't get with projection. But in a case of like if you want when you're using LED, you need to be able to have your focus point about 10 feet like downstage of your LED, depending on the pixel pitch of the LED, or you'll get moiré. You can never focus on the LED itself, but with projection you can. So if you want the ability to rack focus from your subject to your background, to your projection screen, to like stars falling out of the sky or whatever, projections are a better solution for that. And so there are a lot of options where projection is the right choice. We used projection on Top Gun Maverick, because we didn't need all of the we were doing like that classroom scene with all the big windows, and outside there was a 270 degree projection screen with sky on it. And that's all it needed to be. It needed to be the sky outside the window. So using LED for that was overkill. And it was faster and cheaper to focus a dozen projectors and do it that way. So like there are options for both for sure.
That's really good to hear because I think LEDs are the thing that gets all the limelight, or the LED light, if you like. But as you're saying, very recent movies using old school techniques, essentially. Just the right tool for the right job. So another question that came in is, what is it like to come from theater into VR? What was that path?
Again, like it happened on accident. It was a step from designing scenery to designing projections to programming projections, to programming media servers that were going onto LED walls for live events, and then a step from that to in-camera visual effects, like programming the same like 2D media servers for that. And then a step from that to using tools like Unreal for 3D workflows in in-camera visual effects, and then into like VR and XR. And so I just made a bunch of left turns and then ended up here. But the like productions tend to feel the same of like a bunch of people who are all really good at what they do and all good at different things working together to achieve one creative goal. And so that translates really well from theater to something like XR, like virtual production. I mean, a lot of the core team of Lux were theater lighting designers before they got into this, and it's just like it's a combination of working with a team like that, and then also just being enough of a nerd to be excited about the technology and being like, hey, this is cool. What else can we do? What can we do next?
So you obviously leverage a lot coming from using the same technologies in live, where all this was borrowed from live events and borrowed into the film world. What was the kind of diff like in kind of coming into the film side of things? How much was there to learn about how film is made and the culture and the kind of Unreal Engine being one of the tools, I guess?
I mean, there are differences in culture between a theater production, a film set, and a broadcast show, and each one like takes a little bit of getting used to understand both the like culture and the hierarchy and the like structure of those teams. So there's, I think it just takes time. It takes time being on them, time like a little bit of time being uncomfortable and not knowing who to ask and walking up to someone and being like, hey, I don't know the answer to this. Where should I start? Who should I ask? Where should I go? That kind of thing. And like that, it takes putting your ego aside a little bit. Which is always hard.
Everyone's got one.
Yeah.
But yeah, humility is a great an important one of the first pieces of advice I got stepping into industry. I remember meeting my person that ran the first visual effects company I worked for and asked for their I just went to go say hi and then gave me some advice. I can't remember if I asked for it or not, but they said be nice. That was one of the pieces of advice was be nice.
Yeah.
Because this is a community effort and every you never know who it is that you're meeting with or talking to, or whether you're on the way up or on the way down, you're like your people will help you on the way up and they'll remember you in the future. And just being humble, being curious, being driven, be nice. I think it's good advice on the non-technical end of how to succeed in the industry, how to last in the industry.
For sure. Yeah. And like I like to study the call sheet before almost every shoot, just to get an understanding of like what all these roles are and what their structure is. And it's not always super telling, but it's it just kind of gets me comfortable and gives me a chance to like try and remember people that I've met before too. Like, you know, we meet so many people in this industry and we're each other's allies and best friends and confidants for a week, and then we don't see them again for 3 years. And so being able to like take a minute with the call sheet and review the names and remember who I'm excited to see, and maybe send a text of like, hey, I get to see you next week in Korea or whatever, is really like, it's really helpful and really grounding in a way of like reminding yourself like, you know, like these are the people that make me excited about my job. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's good being prepared, but also, the people side of it is huge. Do you have any like, do you have a favorite project that you got to work on in virtual production?
I wonder if it says something about me that. Like when I think of my favorite project, it is immediately the hardest project I've ever done.
That's good to say. Yeah.
It's, yeah. League of Legends Worlds 2020. We got to work on an XR stage that we built for everything from play-ins through semifinals of this esports tournament. And so this was fall of 2020. I spent almost 2 months in Shanghai, starting in quarantine and then ending up building the stage and running it for weeks. We did 270 hours of live broadcast
wow.
XR content with four cameras, and like it hardest thing I've ever done. And absolutely the coolest thing I've ever done. And like that, like I look back on clips from that, and there are parts of that show that like, and you can like Google the behind the scenes part stuff, but like there are shots that I watch and I'm like, well, that wouldn't have worked if that dancer wasn't on every mark and that Steadicam up wasn't kicking ass and like just following the fact that what was in his camera view was not what was outside. And the guy wrangling his cable running after him and the VAD team creating something that I never would have imagined. And I just like, it was a group of people that were really passionate about trying something completely different, and they were so willing to learn. And I think that that's a lot of the hurdles of virtual production, is that like we're utilizing new workflows that a lot of people who've been in the industry for like years and years aren't super comfortable with. And there's so much about like this industry that like I think has been the same for decades, and that people have been doing the same job for decades, working in the same ways, and like aren't comfortable with something changing. So on this project, we had four camera operators who were all incredible at their jobs and had all been working in broadcast in esports for years and years. And suddenly we were telling them that like they could set up a shot, but when we switched the frustum view that was projected onto the LED wall, what they would see in their shot would change. So they would like, they would focus up on, you know, a sign or something to start their shot, and then we'd switch cameras. And it would completely change. And that took a lot of practice for them to get used to and start to work around. And so it took a lot of, I think, patience from everyone's perspective for us to sit together and be like, okay, like these are all the ways we've completely changed the job that you've been doing expertly for decades. Can you learn it? And they did, and they crushed it. And like, it was such a cool experience to work with those, like, those operators, those directors, those artists. And also it was fall of 2020 in China. It was just a weird time.
But I can imagine. Yeah.
still my favorite.
That's cool. Yeah, definitely really interesting that you went for the difficult one. I was wondering if you would, and I often do if I'm asked that question, because at the time you're maybe feeling the pinch a little bit, but afterwards you just realize how much, maybe this is true for you, it's usually for me the ones that make me grow the most and the ones mm-hmm. I like because of that. But at the time they can be they can be stressful and difficult moments to get through, but they make you grow the most usually.
Yeah
it's a real, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that one posed the most like technical and creative challenges, and there was no choice but to figure it out, and like everyone was eager to figure it out. I think that's still like the biggest XR project I've ever done, and it was live, which was a whole other hurdle, and we were live switching cameras, which was just another journey. And so there were like so many steps to what made it cool that like it was exciting. I'm still like so proud of that project and that team.
I bet. Yeah, well, it was very cool. I was aware of that at the time, and yeah, very definitely impressive. Everybody should go check it out for sure. How about in the movie side, any favorite movies you got to work on?
I will be honest, I haven't worked on a ton of movies. I've done I guess
Top Gun, you did.
Three, uh-huh. Four in my time at Lux. I got to do Top Gun, which was great. I really also loved working on Bullet Train, which turned out to be a really beautiful movie. We did LED walls on either side of that train, but I essentially watched that entire movie without audio because we had a monitor and that was it. And we were just looking at the visuals. And then I watched the movie and I was like, oh, so that's why that happened. And that was that was a fun process too.
That's cool. What, as you've essentially been in the industry for roughly as long as it's existed, how have you seen it evolve over that time and mature?
I mean, there are a lot more people doing it now. Hmm. I think a couple of years ago we hit like this bubble started growing of everyone starting a virtual production company and everyone building a volume and all of that, which I think is great in some senses and challenging in some senses. I mean, of course it adds competition, which is challenging, but there's also like there, when that started, there weren't straightforward guidelines on how to do it. And so I think in some senses that confused a lot of people. I think like it got a lot more people with their hands on the software, which I think is really exciting, or their hands on the tools to do these things. And it became something that more people could use. And I think, I mean, like it was our problem on, or our biggest challenge on Worlds, being able to educate artists on the new tools available. Like the new tools aren't always the right choice, but having those as options, I think is something that's only going to move our field forward. And so I think in the last year or so, especially with the strikes and the major challenges in this industry, like some of that has slimmed down, and there are some people on the forefront of this of this project or of this process, and it can be something that's used a little bit more mainstream and used a little more consistently.
Right. And in terms of the the tools and the hardware and software evolved, how has that changed over the years?
I mean, it only gets better, right? Like, we went from, I think a lot of media server companies are making an effort to make more user-friendly almost skins for these game engines so that they can be more accessible for XR uses to the average user. I think there is still a major push from Epic Games on the Unreal Engine. I know that they just in the last year have monetized their software, but for the longest time it was free, and like that got a lot of people using it. And so now it's kind of a staple in the industry, as is Unity. And so these tools are constantly getting better and constantly trying to adapt to an ever-changing industry. And like camera tracking is getting more and more accurate and more consistent, which I think is something that's going to make this a lot easier to use for things like live broadcast. I think some of the next steps are like getting color workflows a little more organized, because color science is not something that is my specialty at all, but is such an important part of production of all sorts of all video. When you're pairing video with a camera, it does weird things. So like, I think making that easier for the end user is going to be one of the next steps. And I think continued education is going to be huge. I'm also excited. Yeah. I'm also excited to see where things like Ghost Frame take us in terms of being able to do multi-camera live broadcast.
Maybe not everybody knows what that is. Do you want to?
Oh, yeah. So Ghost Frame is a process that allows you to essentially shoot two different things on the same LED wall. So when you're thinking about a film, you're shooting at 24 frames per second, or at least that's average. You would ideally play the content back on your wall also at 24 frames a second and genlock them. Genlock is essentially a metronome for video that tells both things when to refresh their frame so that you're always capturing the freshest frame. And so this keeps things from like, this is why if you take an iPhone video of your computer, it flickers. It's because it's not genlocked. So you would that's the typical workflow. Now with something like Ghost Frame, you would operate at 96 frames a second, which is four times as much. And the first three frames, so every four frames would be one frame of video captured. So the first three frames would be one plate and the fourth frame would be a different plate. So like you could do an environment and say that like, okay, like say we want, you know, a tree background or whatever. That could be your first three frames. And then your fourth frame could be a green screen, like a chroma green. And you would shoot that with two cameras that are genlocked to the different sources so that one was capturing the second frame and one was capturing the fourth frame. And the reason that you don't do every other is because it would strobe and make everyone sick. But if you're dividing it by four and you're having three frames as one, your brain kind of cancels out that fourth frame. And just kind of blocks it out. And so your brain's only seeing the trees. Everyone on set is only seeing the trees. One of your cameras is only seeing the trees. And then one camera is capturing it over a chroma green backdrop, a green screen backdrop that you can essentially key out and put in anything. So that's very useful for projects where like the director's not fully sure that finished environment is finished, or like they might want to change something, so they're capturing green as a backup. It's also really useful for if you want to give it like two backgrounds or something, or like in broadcast environments, maybe like being able to record someone sitting at like a sports station desk and then also on the field. And so it gives you that flexibility of doing multi-camera better. I think it also allows you to, if you're doing a two-camera shoot in 3D, one of the tools that we use in camera visual effects is tracking a frustum. And so that allows us to capture what is seen in the field of view of the camera and project that onto the LED wall. And that works until two cameras cross paths and then one needs to win. But if you're doing this ghost frame, like multi-camera workflow, those two paths can cross each other and just be capturing at different rates and be capturing each their own frustum, each their own field of view in perspective.
Right. It definitely did to me, and I think to others too. But yeah, thanks for going through that. I know it's not everybody knows what it is at all, but probably people don't know all the different things that you can do with it potentially. So yeah, it was really, really cool to hear about that. Any thoughts on, I'm going to call it machine learning, AI, if you like, that seems to be a very hot topic right now. Any places that you're seeing that already showing up in workflows, or any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think some of the ways that we've seen tools like this, or at least like the starting point of tools like this in use, is for automating camera tracking calibrations by projecting a grid and essentially using the computer to detect where the camera is based off of that and set origin points that way. So I think that will continue to grow and fine tune and become better. I think there's so many possibilities that like someone's going to find some really cool way to use these tools. The same way we ended up with virtual production in a way that people didn't entirely expect. I think that AI and machine learning will be used to enhance virtual production, but then also create new filmmaking tools and new tools of creation in general.
Right. Yeah. We're not seeing a ton of them actually in use currently, but yet the promise of things, especially things like nerfs, Gaussian splatting, that type mm-hmm. of new way of having a containing or storing or displaying a 3D captured environment, whereas photogrammetry has always been the king and still is essentially, but seeing any of that in the wild yet?
Not quite yet. And there's been a lot of testing of it. I've heard of a lot of people like, okay, let's start playing with these tools, but I haven't actually seen it on a production yet. But I'm excited for what's next. I think that there's a really interesting possibility with virtual production of like, you know, if you get a LiDAR scan of every set you build, you can do reshoots anywhere, anytime. And like, that's just, that opens up so many possibilities in filmmaking. And especially when we're thinking about like sequels and bringing shows back, like there's so much more that you can archive and that you can revive and fine tune. And like, it's going to get really cool, and I'm excited for it.
It's interesting because one of the things that excites me too is the unknown, and mm-hmm. in that knowing, one of the things I think that let me know that computer graphics was something that held a huge amount of interest for me was just I felt like there was so much to know, there was so much already that had already been invented that there was to know, but now we're in this phase where not only is there a lot to know that's already been created that there is to learn, but there's also a huge amount of change going on, and describing this, the advent of virtual production and all of the new types of things that's unlocked in terms of filmmaking, but then now adding these new possibilities with machine learning tools to the mix. I think we're seeing a lot of uncertainty created by it mm-hmm. and a lot of excitement, which those two tend to come together a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense to see people being fearful of it, in my opinion, and also excited by it. And probably care needs to be taken as we explore it. But but it is exciting to see the new possibilities, for sure. Mm-hmm. Someone else asking a question here as well at the end as we wrap up. I'd like to know what technical skill sets and or software packages you think are necessary for a junior or aspiring VP soup these days, knowing that soft skills are a given.
Yeah, I think getting comfortable with some forms of camera tracking, whether it's just like reading the manuals or stuff like that, just that you can communicate with someone who's doing 3D workflows, and then getting to really understand a system and the importance of timecode and Genlock, I think, are vital. And then any sort of either media server knowledge or game engine knowledge, I think, is really valuable. As a VP soup, a lot of the times it's just being able to like be the translator between the creative and the production and a very technical team. And so you don't need to be an expert in any of those things, but being able to speak the language and understand the challenges, I think, is really valuable. And also, you're welcome to add me on LinkedIn and continue to ask questions if you'd like.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, appreciate that. Any more to that? Any more like what do you think make good kind of fundamental skills?
I think being comfortable in like on a film set is absolutely vital, and having a strong enough understanding of like camera workflows to be able to like have a conversation with a gaffer, because a lot of the times you have to be able to have a conversation with the cinematographer of what they want to capture. So it's a lot of times it's just like understanding all of that language and understanding the vocabulary used in those situations, which honestly, it takes time. I would say even like 3 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to have all those conversations that I do now on a regular basis. But being able to like understand and like, and accept when you don't know something, be like, I don't understand the problem. Can you explain that to me? What is it specifically you need? And then source that knowledge. I think that that's really valuable as well. But I think, yeah, you kind of, it's a jack of all trades kind of role, where you need to have an understanding of every element so that you can go talk to the venue team about when we're going to get internet run to us, but then also turn around and like have a conversation with the VAD team about what you need in your specific like blueprints or what they need in their post-process level. And so it just takes time. And I would say, don't rush yourself. You don't have to know everything the first time you do it. And be willing to accept when you don't, and say so to the right people, say so to your team. I would never walk onto a stage and tell someone I don't know what I'm doing, but to my team,
is the first thing you say,
no. But to my team, I'll be like, hey, I don't fully understand that. Can you explain it to me so that I can better have this conversation with someone else? And they know that like at the end of the day, I'm there to protect them, and I'm there to give them as much as I can. And so they'll take the time to explain that to me. And if a client asks me a question or an artist asks me a question and I don't know the answer, I'll say, I'm going to circle back with my team and get back to you.
Yeah. It's really important. I totally agree to not claim that you know something when you don't, and say something just that you're making up, hoping that it's right, but like being real about it, but also bringing that certainty that the person, that your mm-hmm. client is going to get the solution and you're working on it, and just bringing that confidence and certainty to them as you're working on it.
Yeah,
very, very cool. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share with our audience? Any places that they can follow you? I know you've generously offered your LinkedIn connection. Thank you for that. But yeah, anywhere else?
Yeah, feel free to add me on LinkedIn. I mean, I'm also on Instagram, but it's not nearly as interesting. So like the LinkedIn's in the chat.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And it's been a really fascinating conversation, going all the way through lots of technical things, but lots of very fundamental things that I think apply to probably to several industries, but certainly to this one, some often not talked about things, and then even things to do with your own personal journey and discovery and the ongoing exploration of what we're supposed to be doing on planet Earth. I really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
You bet. Well, hopefully we'll get to have you back sometime and talk about the next part of your journey.
Yeah. When I figured out work-life balance, I'll call you.
Definitely call me on that one. I will do a two-episode special at least.
Perfect.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And thank you also to our live studio audience. Thanks for being here and making this a great experience and for asking good questions and sponsoring the conversation in that way. I'd also just like to say on the side of CG Pro, the school, we have an open day tonight. If anyone's interested in joining us for that, during the open day, we'll go through some example instruction. We'll get you get to meet some instructors and some recruiters. So I just wanted to put that out there. Hopefully the links will be going into the chat about our open day. We also have a brand new event calendar on the website at becomecgpro.com, where you can see all of the live events that we do, including these podcasts. So if you're ever curious about the things that we're doing, the live events that we're doing, go check out our event calendar. And again, thank you all very much. I hope you're all having a fantastic 2024 already. This is a great time, I think, to reflect on the previous year and think about what you accomplished, what you didn't, reasons for that, think about goals for this year. I've certainly got some of my own, stuck them up on the wall and chipping away at them already. But it's a great moment to do that. Either way, keep doing awesome stuff, make cool art, push yourself, go for some big goals this year. And we're here for you, and CG Pro is here for you if we can help at all with that. But thanks again for a great podcast, and we'll see you all again in a couple of weeks for the next one. Take care, everybody.